This is Line One, Your Health Connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard, your host, and I'll introduce my guest shortly. One brief promotional activity this evening at 7 p.m. at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium. Dr. Elizabeth Vallette will be speaking. She's going to be talking about making sense of the headlines about hormones. Mainly this is for women. She's written a couple of books on women's health issues, including It's My Ovaries, Stupid, Screaming to Be Heard, Hormone Connections and Women Hormone Connections, Women Suspect, and Doctors Ignore. And the other book that she wrote is Women, Weight, and Hormones. That's a free admission, 7 o'clock tonight. At the Wendy Williams Williamson Auditorium. Another thing I like to do at the beginning of programs is talk about how we know what we know and keep asking ourselves, is what we know really true? And as a physician, a pediatrician, I'm constantly trying to talk parents into immunizing their children. One of the bigger concerns that have been more difficult recently has been chickenpox vaccine, not because of any particular dangers, but because so many families worry or think that chickenpox is a fairly benign illness. And certainly compared to pertussis, particularly pertussis in young infants, polio, we could argue that it is somewhat benign. But we do have some information now, and I'll give you what we know about what's happened since chickenpox vaccines have been instituted several years ago, and then you can ask yourself, are chickenpox vaccinations worthwhile? The vaccinations were begun in 1995, and since then, the incidence of varicella has decreased 90%. The number of varicella-related hospitalizations has declined about 80%. Deaths have declined about 74% in people under 50, but 92% in children 1 to 4, and about 90% in ages 5 to 9. There's been a tremendous decrease in inpatient, outpatient medical costs with a decline of about 74%. Despite the success of the vaccine, recent studies have felt that it was not enough to change what is known as herd immunity, and a second booster vaccine has been recommended. The school district will be requiring that, my understanding is, of 2009, although most of us are trying to get kids their second dose already. So you can take that information that we now know and decide whether the chickenpox vaccine is worth it in your own mind. My guest today is Dr. Brad Cruz. Dr. Cruz is a pediatric radiologist. He works at Alaska Regional Hospital, and he informed me not too long ago he's also the radiation safety officer, and we're going to ask about what that all means shortly. Brad, welcome to Line One.
Hi, Thad. Hello, listeners. It's a pleasure to be on your show. I was honored by the request to come talk.
Thanks. Yeah, you're one that I haven't had on in the number of years I've been doing. I've kept looking for reasons, and there's been a little bit of a blip in the literature about concerns about radiation, not only in children, but all the way across the board. So that's what led us to this particular program. I like to put things in perspective and kind of work forward. I want to talk about what radiation is, where it comes from, what do we know about risk, and then talk about specific x-rays. Then we'll talk about what's really been going on recently that drives this factor. So when we say the term radiation, put that in some perspective.
Well, the radiation we're talking about today is in a particular part of the electromagnetic spectrum, which is quite intense and sufficiently intense that it can cause atoms to undergo ionization, and it turns them into very, very reactive parts of a molecule. And so in shorthand, or what that means in lay speak, is that these photons can damage proteins and molecules inside your DNA, and they're harmful.
And we learned about that particular risk fairly quickly after the recognition of X-rays, I suspect.
Yes, it's true. within about a decade or two after Rentgen discovered the X-rays and, you know, had made this tube, and people were going all over the world and the U.S. Demonstrating these new X-ray tubes and what you could do with them. The people who handled these tubes, which were unshielded, and they were demonstrating these things on their own bodies, and the helpers were testing them to make sure they were working right on their own hands, and folks started getting blisters and skin rashes and fingertips started falling off, and then they started dying of cancer. And so within about 20 years of the discovery of the X-ray tube, they began to recognize that what was coming out of there was harmful. Mm-hmm. The next big recognition came after the discovery of radium, when people were playing with radium pretty haphazardly and wantonly. People started getting sick from that. And then the next big wave of cognition about radiation hazards was when we blew the bombs up over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and people suffered all manner of radiation illness from that.
Where does, again, I'm always thinking in perspective, putting a problem or what we're working on into some bigger frame of reference so we can understand the importance of it. Where does radiation come from?
Well, what we're talking about here on this show today is medical radiation,
right,
which comes from X-ray tubes,
right,
that we use to make X-ray pictures of people, and from nuclear medicine.
Mm-hmm.
MRI also is a form of electromagnetic radiation, but it's not as energetic, and it's no more harmful to you than the radio waves coming out of your cell phone. Ultrasound is a type of radiation too, but it's very, very low energy by comparison, and it doesn't seem to harm anybody that we know of, with one tiny exception, which you have a question on this little talking point sheet we can talk about if time allows.
Okay. But we're all exposed to radiation coming from space on a daily basis. So just to kind of put things in perspective is what I was trying to do.
Absolutely true. The sun is putting out huge amounts of radiations of all types, neutrons, protons, gamma rays, and our atmosphere shields us for most of that. Right. When people are out in space, in the space lab and in the space shuttle, they're getting zapped with a lot more radiation than we are here on the surface of the Earth. And airline pilots and cockpit crew who spend a lot of time up in the upper parts of the atmosphere, they get more radiation than we do here on the ground. Mm. People in Denver,
right,
get about twice the background radiation that people at sea level get.
So when we're talking about the risk of medical radiation, it needs to be kept in mind that in addition to that, there's a background risk that all of us sustain, which is somewhat variable, maybe not importantly variable, but like you said, even going up a mile into elevation on planet Earth exposes us to a little bit more potentially dangerous radiation,
yeah,
exposure.
The radiation that we're exposed to naturally comes from outer space in large part, and also from naturally occurring radioactive stuff that's in soils and in building materials, and the radon gas coming up out of the ground. All those are sources of radiation, and the net effect of that is in people living at sea level like us here in Anchorage, we get approximately what's called 150 MR per year, milligrams. It's a unit of measure of radiation, and we get about 150 per year is our dose combined from outer space and from stuff that's on the ground and in the building material and in the water we drink and the radon in the air we breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And the contribution from medical X-ray exposure and nuclear medicine X-ray exposure now has increased about sixfold in the past two decades, so that now it's about 360 MR per year, where it used to be less than background radiation or real similar to background radiation.
All right, so that's an important issue that we want to discuss. Is one of the reasons we're probably here is that there is evidence that we have increased the above a background amount of radiation from medical therapies, and there's now some concern that may lead to problems. We don't really have clear evidence of problems at this point, and we're trying to head them off. Is that fair to say?
The evidence that there's a problem is not direct.
Okay.
It's just a risk that people worry about. And the reason for that is that the cancers that are induced by medical X-ray exposure, those cancers look the same and act the same as any other cancer. You can't tell the difference between a breast cancer that was induced from irradiation of the breast from a cancer that just happened for no good reason at all. There's no way to tell them apart. So, and the additional cancers are relatively small in comparison to the background incidence of all these different cancers.
Let me take a brief second and remind our listeners you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Brad Cruz, and we're talking about risks of medical imaging modalities to our health. If you've got questions about anything you hear today, there's a couple of ways you can get through to us. One, you can call direct at 550-8433. 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email during the program at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. Normally the program repeats between 7 and 8 on KSKA each evening, but tonight we're going to be preempted by coverage of the National Democratic Convention. That does not mean you can't listen to the program or have someone listen to it. You can go to kska.org /line1 and at any time go to this podcast and listen to it in the future. Email it to someone if you'd like, and you can even subscribe so that you get it on a regular basis. Well, let's now talk about what a X-ray is. What a medical X-ray? How is that generated? What does it do?
You mean the physics object or the exam?
Yeah, the exam, I guess, is what I'm really getting at. I hadn't thought about it in those terms. But I'm trying to make sure we all understand, because then I'm going to move towards tomography and CAT scans and so forth.
You have to rein me in, because I was a chemistry and physics major in college, and I'll start talking about bombarding tungsten targets with electrons accelerated across a huge electrical potential. But we'll skip all that.
So that's why you're the radiation safety officer.
Yeah, because I'm a techno geek. No, an X-ray exam involves exposing a person's body part, the part you're interested in looking at, to an X-ray beam. And then on the other side of the patient from where the X-rays come out of the tube, you have some sort of image receptor. It used to be film inside a little light-tight box that had a screen that would glow when the X-rays hit it. And the glowing of the X-rays had the pattern of the shadow of the person or body part that was in the beam. Well, nowadays, most people are switching over to digital X-ray or computed radiography, where the X-ray beam with the shadow pattern from the person's body part is in that device, and you put it into a reader, a computer-like device, that extracts the information and then displays it on a monitor as a picture. And the picture shows things that you can only see when you can see through somebody. Visible light doesn't penetrate through people very well, but X-rays do. And so you can see parts that are inside hidden under the skin. Mm-hmm. And that's the point of it, is to see the bones and the lungs and the organ shadows and so on, and kidney stones and this and that that you want to look at.
Okay. And so relative to our background radiation exposure here on Earth, are we able to make a comparison between that and, let's say, a chest X-ray?
Well, a chest X-ray is a nice handy unit of measure. For purposes of comparing, say, a CT scan to a radiograph of the skull, it actually would be more logical to use the skull X-ray as a comparison, and a chest CT as a comparison unit to describe the dose from a chest CT, and so on and so forth. So, for example, a chest CT scan would be about between 90 and 150 chest X-rays worth.
In the amount of radiation the person's getting is being exposed.
And one chest X-ray is equal to about half of your annual background radiation exposure from outer space and from the dirt and the bricks and things that surround us.
Okay. And what exactly does CT stand for, and what does that mean? Tell us.
Computed tomography is another way of making an X-ray image of somebody. Mm-hmm. In this case, there's a big machine with a hole in the middle of it the big box with a hole in it we call the gantry. And inside that gantry is an X-ray tube that orbits around the person. And coming out of that X-ray tube is a little thin fan-shaped beam. It's small. The pointy end of the pizza pie piece shape beam is at the X-ray tube, and it flares out as it shines through the person and hits the detectors on the other side of the gantry. And this whole affair spins around the person beaming X-rays through, and so it looks at a person from every possible angle on its way around. Mm-hmm. And then from that, a computer reconstructs the cross-sectional image of the person so that you see what's inside of them, like you see when you cut across a log and count the growth rings.
Mm-hmm.
That's a cross-section. So the CT image is a cross-sectional X-ray of a person.
And in simple terms, and I don't want to oversimplify and misunderstand it, it's the reason there's more exposure to radiation, it is really multiple X-rays computed together.
Correct. A CT scan is more dose intense because you get the beams shown into you from every angle as the machine orbits around you. And the way normally a body is scanned is you're going through on a table as this thing is going around you.
Mm-hmm.
And so it spirals through your whole volume, shining X-rays on you from every direction as it spins around. Okay. So the X-ray exposure is rather more than a single one-time flash exposure of a piece of film or a flat cassette detector.
Obviously, the technology, particularly medical technology in this country and I guess around the world, is just continues to grow almost exponentially. What significant changes have happened in, let's say, computerized tomography, CT scanning, that has improved the ability to use these, and with that improvement, has safety improved, stayed the same, or worsened?
Well, I actually am just old enough that I was around when CT was invented. And we had, where I trained, a primitive single-slice machine that would take about 9.8 seconds to go around a person, and then it had to stop and then change direction and go back the other way to make the next slice. And each, it only made one slice at a time, and then the person would go in 1 centimeter at a time, and the machine would take 9.8 seconds to go back around. And so you can imagine it would take a long time to scan a person.
Mm-hmm.
And we had one CT scanner that served the entire military population of Northern California and our outlying bases.
Mm-hmm.
So the line was pretty long. It was hard to get a scan. We couldn't get very many patients per day, and not that many patients got scans. There was a real bottleneck. Well, now that issue has been resolved by many factors, one of which is the cost of the machines came down to where lots of people can afford them, and there are numerous machines in Anchorage now. The advent of the so-called spiral machine, where the machine is on tracks with brushes, and so it never has to stop. It spins around at about 3 revolutions per second, and it's spitting out a 5 centimeter thick beam now. Instead of a little 1 centimeter thick beam, it's about 5 centimeters thick, and the image receptor on the other side is divided into lots of little channels, so we can gather a lot of data per rotation, and it's spinning 3 times per second, so we can feed someone through very quickly and scan them from head to toe in 20 or 30 seconds. So that means that we can knock out a lot of exams per day. And there are a lot of machines around town that can do this. And so availability is not the bottleneck anymore. You can get a scan anytime, anywhere, just about.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I think that was one of the big deals, was the increase in the capacity of the machines and the increase in the number of the machines. And then there are other factors. The image quality keeps getting better, and so we're getting better at making diagnoses. And so CT scan diagnoses have replaced the older traditional X-ray methods. Like, for example, the IVP for people with kidney stones and kidney tumors used to be a several-hour process sometimes, multiple X-ray exposures. And for people with kidneys obstructed by stone or tumor, it would take hours to finally get the contrast to where we wanted to see. Well, now you can do all that in just a minute or two with the CT scanner.
Mm-hmm.
Kidney stone diagnosis is no problem anymore. So that was a good replacement. That was worth the extra exposure. ditto pulmonary embolism, where people throw blood clots from leg veins or pelvic veins into their lung arteries and block them up, and they get terribly short of breath and sick as can be really fast. We used to have some rather imperfect methods of making that diagnosis, including angiography, where we had to put a catheter up a major vessel right into their pulmonary arteries and squirt big doses of contrast. We don't do that anymore. We do CT scans. It's real quick. It's a lot safer for the patient, and it's every bit as accurate as angiography and way better than the nuclear medicine test it replaced. So there are good reasons why we do a lot more CT diagnosis than we used to. Another factor, one more factor, and that is two things actually, the protocol-driven workups in places like emergency rooms, where there are these articles that say that for such and such a mechanism of injury, there's a certain predictable rate of trauma to different organ systems and body parts. And so for a certain mechanism of injury, like being ejected from the vehicle, you're supposed to scan them from head to toe. So that's really added up to a lot of extra CT scans. And you know, sometimes I get the feeling that they follow these protocols even when the patient is protesting his innocence and trying to leave the emergency room. And then I think the other factor is self-referral. People have machines in their offices, and I think that tends to encourage because of its ready availability and for other reasons that I won't speculate on. I think people tend to get more CTs per capita when the machines are operated by the person who's making the decision to order the test.
So obviously convenience, and we're getting better pictures and it's easier to use. But how about the safety? Has the relative exposure changed, or has it increased, or is it about the same? I'm talking about just CT scans, not trying to compare an IVP where you're doing something different to a CT now for a stone.
Well, you know, my initial thought when I heard about these multi-channel CTs was that they would – that the thickness of the beam compared to the older single-slice machines would make the dose some big multiple. Like, for example, if the new beam is 5 centimeters thick, I thought, well, that must be then that it's 5 times more dose than the old 1 centimeter thick beam single-slice machines we used to use. Not so at all. Because the patients buzz through there so much faster – the increased X-ray exposure from spiral CT machines is actually only about 20% more than a single-slice machine. The biggest reason why the doses have gone up so much is because it's so easy now to scan more than you need to.
It's
only about an extra 10 seconds or less to scan the pelvis, when we used to maybe stop at the abdomen because that was already a 15-minute piece of work. Well, now it's 10 seconds of work, and so we just find it pretty easy to just go on down and scan the pelvis too. Sometimes that's good, sometimes it's not.
Right, and it's human nature. I mean, that's one of the knocks against antibiotics is certainly they were so effective, and again, CT scans are very effective, but when things get very effective, they have a tendency to get overused.
Well, I think that's true. People start to get casual, and they sort of devalue things that are so easy to do and so readily available.
Another knee-jerk response, however, which is negative, is that people give up on antibiotics and think they're all bad, and that's absolutely the wrong thing. I find myself fighting that battle. There's no question we overuse antibiotics, and I'm suspect you're going to say, and I've already kind of said, we may be using overdoing CT. That does not mean we should stop using these things.
The data that says we're overusing CT is simply this. The incidence of disease hasn't changed much.
Okay.
Some diseases are actually going down. Most diseases about the same as it always has been. So if we're doing 6 times more CT scans than we were doing a decade or two ago, that means that our batting average has gone down by the same factor or the inverse of that factor.
Yeah, good point. Okay, Oak, we have a caller. Let's go ahead and take Diane. Diane, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi, good choice. I'm glad you had Dr. Gruse on. I have three quick questions. When I make an effort to make sure that my old X-rays are saved for comparison purposes, and isn't really that the point of having the old ones, why is it when you either have a chest or a mammogram or, say, a back, that when you read the radiologist report, they will say that that the current one has been compared with the last one, but never the one from maybe 3 or 4 years ago or 10 years ago? Is it just a lack of time or interest in doing it, or a lack of value? And also, when I have bone density scans, I find often that the machines have changed. This is not necessarily in Dr. Cruz's hospital, but the machines change so often, and then when I get the report, it says, oh, well, we can't really compare your bone density with last time because it's a different machine, and they for some reason can't compare with the old one. And I would think that the hospital administration would insist before they get a new machine that comparison is built into the programming, because that's the whole point. And the last question is, talk about MRI contrast media and the safety issues that people should know about, especially with gadolinium, and, you know, perhaps the tests that they should be sure they have to make sure they don't have kidney disease, and perhaps some other contrast media that we should be aware of and before we go and have
right.
those tests.
Okay. Yeah, that question came up not too long about MRI contrast, or a caller called in. I don't know if that was you or not, Diane, before. But
probably.
All right. Well, we'll address those. You want to take that off the air?
Sure.
Okay. Thanks for your call. All right, so lack of use of prior x-rays in some comparisons is the first question.
Yeah, I think that's a multi-part answer. And now with the things that are on PACS, PACS being an acronym for Picture Archiving and Communication System, that's the digital method of moving x-rays around. We're not moving x-ray films anymore. We don't have great big bags of heavy x-rays to play with, and we don't have too many of those big old view boxes that you see on TV on the medical shows anymore. We look at monitors. We have these high-resolution monitors, and we look at the pictures on a computer. And at Alaska Regional, we've got about 3 years' worth of data now in that form. And when we have a patient come in whose prior films were on film, we have a way to digitize the most recent comparison studies. We don't, as a matter of routine, digitize every single thing from their old jacket. That would probably be kind of wasteful. So if it turns out that we need to, we can. And when I'm looking at comparison studies to make a report, I look at the question at hand and determine if the most recent one is the one and only relevant exam, or does the issue at hand require me to look back over several exams? So it's a case-by-case review. I have to confess, though, at times probably it could simply be a matter of expediency that they only compare to one. Mm-hmm. And it may be a case of availability if the study I need is in an x-ray in a basement somewhere and it's not immediately available, then I will not compare it, obviously, until I get it. And if it's an issue, then I just dictate a caveat that I'm going to get the old film and make an addendum later. So we try to compare, and we don't always compare to multiple old ones unless it's important. Regarding the issue of DEXAs, that is an annoying thing that I...
DEXAs, the bone density.
Yeah, that's a dual energy x-ray absorption way of measuring bone density. And I find it extraordinarily annoying that the manufacturers, when they update their machines, don't make them so that they spit out exactly the same number on exactly the same bone. It must be an engineering thing that they can't seem to all agree how to measure the same piece of bone and get the same answer. There are people who figure out the correlation and make tables so you can try to correlate it, but it's not simple. And it's just one of those annoying things about the equipment manufacturing industry that they do that. Regarding MRI contrast, it's a whole different subject. But, yeah, the MRI replaced a lot of x-ray exams because it's non-ionizing and it's superior in many ways for many exams. And the contrast, we thought initially, was non-toxic, but it turns out that in people whose kidneys don't get rid of this stuff promptly, the chemical form of the tracer gadolinium is such that it will break down over time. And gadolinium is a toxic heavy metal made non-toxic by the way it's hooked up into the contrast molecules. Unfortunately, as it hangs around in the body, not being excreted because of poor kidney function, it starts to fall apart and the gadolinium gets loose and causes a syndrome called systemic fibrosis. Exactly what the risk is and the dose required and all that is still undergoing evaluation. It's not as simple as everybody with renal failure who gets gadolinium gets systemic fibrosis, but it is a reported complication. There is a risk of it. And so I've known for years about this, so I've been trying to screen people with kidney function troubles away from getting gadolinium.
Okay. All right. Remind our listeners again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Brad Cruz, a radiologist at Regional Hospital, the radiation safety officer as well. And we're talking about the relative risks of medical imaging, how medical imaging has changed over the years, what has that done to individuals' risks, and what are being done about changing those risks in various ways. So if you've got questions or comments, 550-8433 is our local number, 550-8433. You can also call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752 or email us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. And just a reminder again, we're not going to be rebroadcasting this program between 7 and 8, as normally happens, as there's going to be coverage of the Democratic National Convention. But you can go to kska.org/line1 and listen to the podcast or refer someone to listen at a later date if you would like. What's the Image Gently campaign, Dr. Cruz?
The Image Gently campaign is an initiative that was sponsored initially by the Society of Pediatric Radiology because we were recognizing that the spiral CT scan technology had the potential to cause a lot of overexposure in kids. And we worry about exposure in children because known from the Hiroshima and Nagasaki data is the fact that children are way more radiation sensitive in terms of getting cancer than our adults. And so pediatric radiologists have been for years worried about this issue. It was pediatric radiologists who managed to finally extinguish the practice of irradiating thymuses and irradiating acne and irradiating tinea capitis because we were worried about that. And in fact, back in the 50s when they were doing this stuff, they were producing some thyroid cancers and other issues in kids. So we've known that medical therapeutic and diagnostic x-rays are a potential hazard, and kids are especially vulnerable. So the Society of Pediatric Radiology got together with an alliance of a bunch of other professional organizations and launched this campaign called Image Gently. And on their website, which is www.pedrad.org, you can follow the link to Image Gently. And there's information there for parents, information for physicians, and information for x-ray technologists to use about how to minimize the doses that children experience in medical x-ray examinations and CTs.
And incidentally, those of you who are listening, you can go to our website and you can get links directly to those two websites that Dr. Cruz just mentioned. Jim, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, sir. I have a question about the precautions and warnings that I've heard over a number of years about limiting the number of exposures to x-rays, whether it's dental or chest or whatever they are, just for routine purposes, it's not a good idea. And then when I question getting these types of x-rays and stuff from the technicians or the medical facility, they kind of get an attitude about, you know, me being a problem for questioning what they routinely do all the time. And you read this on one side, and then you get this on the other.
Well, you just said something that kind of struck me as a phrase that needs to be addressed, and that is routine purposes. I don't know that there is such a thing as a routine purpose for getting an exposure to ionizing radiation under the guise of medical authority. I think that each and every exposure has to somehow be justified. Now, you might argue that it's routine to do a screening mammogram, but the benefit of that exposure is fairly clearly defined. We've proven that if you get screening mammography and you're in the right age group, you'll experience the benefit of a lifetime breast cancer death risk reduction. So there's a benefit to that screening exam. And in other exams, non-screening exams, there should be no such concept as routine. There ought to be a defined benefit. And I don't think it's an unreasonable thing that a person like yourself, Jim, should say, why am I getting this? How's this going to help? That's not unreasonable.
Yeah.
As long as everybody's educated to the same level of knowledge, and I don't think they are.
Well, I think people get into the habits, physicians, any professional, of just doing things, and it's never wrong to ask. And we should always, as physicians and as patients, be asking, what's the risk-benefit? Now, don't forget, there is no risk-free options out there. That's what most patients want us to be able to tell them, but there's a risk of doing it and the risk of not doing it, and that includes x-rays, antibiotics, not coming to the doctor. All of those things have those things, and they should be weighed. And if the risk of the procedure is greater, as Dr. Cruz has suggested, then it's probably not worthwhile. So I would concur with Dr. Cruz and say, you know, you want to don't feel bad about asking about why are we doing this and what's my risks.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You bet. Good question.
The dose from a medical or a dental X-ray exposure is actually quite tiny, but no one knows exactly where the relationship between dose and risk tails off. Okay. Some people believe that below a certain point there is no risk, and some say it's higher at low dose, and some say it's exactly linear all the way from low to high. But I subscribe to the idea that there is no such thing as a absolutely safe exposure, and every single exposure should be justified, even if it's small, like a dental X-ray exposure.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Dale, you're on line one.
Yeah, I'm curious about the difference in exposure between different equipment. Obviously, the hospitals keep the latest equipment and as it comes out, but some of the individual doctor's offices have equipment that's 20-plus years old. Is there a difference in the way they work that affects the amount of exposure?
Oh, boy, is there ever. Absolutely, and probably the most important factor is the way they process the image. In offices that are still using film, low-volume offices where they don't keep the processor running and inspected and tuned up every single day, to get a picture with the right grayscale may require boosting the dose to the patient by quite a bit if their chemicals in their processor are off. This is actually a widespread problem. It's not the oldness of the X-ray tube that's the big issue. It has to do more with the processing and also the quality of the film and the cassette that the film is in. But this idea that there are higher dose units out there is actually quite valid. There was a program in New Jersey years ago where they decided on their own to undertake a X-ray quality assurance program that was mandated. And they went around and started inspecting X-ray equipment in offices. They required licensure, and they inspected them all. And within a few years, the average dose of different exam types had fallen by about 45% on average. And one of the interesting pieces of data I found in that article was that the number of tubes being examined each year under their licensure program dropped off a lot. And the biggest drop-offs were in chiropractors and podiatrists' offices. They had about a 40% reduction in the number of X-ray tubes licensed and operating. And I suspect it was because they couldn't meet the dose requirements and the quality control things. The number of tubes that were taken out of commission in hospitals and physicians' offices was about 10%. And those were units I think just couldn't meet the standard. So, yeah, an inspection program would unearth some of these disparities that you're talking about.
Okay, Dale, are you still with us?
Yeah, that's interesting. So there's no real standard, but we know that the older equipment
is it regulated in some way?
In this state, yeah. You do have to have a license to operate an X-ray tube, and there's a fellow named Clyde Pierce who works for the state who goes around and inspects all the registered licensed tubes. I don't know if he's measuring doses. It'd be interesting if Clyde is listening and would call in to tell us if he's actually measuring doses for different exposures and what he does about processor maintenance.
Okay. All right, Dale. It's a question I had asked before we came on the air. I was curious about the same issues. It's a good one.
I appreciate the information.
Yeah, thanks for calling. You've kind of addressed this, but I kind of want to highlight it, I guess, again, by talking about that. My research found that there was a recent study of using CTs in the emergency room that found between 2000 and 2006 there was a 65% increase in the number of CT exams ordered on children younger than 17, while the volume only increased 2%, kind of getting back to your saying that the amount of disease hasn't changed. It's the amount of testing that we're doing. And So I guess that begs the question, what can we be doing? What are some of the recommendations that have maybe come out of different organizations, how we can our strategies to reduce some of the radiation exposures?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
I'm sorry, but I can tell you this, that the pediatric volume out of RCT at Alaska Regional Hospital has not gone up to that degree.
Okay.
I haven't noticed that much of a bump in our pediatric ER volume or pediatric CT volume in general.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I'm not being a devil's advocate here. I want to put it into perspective as somebody on the front lines. I know that as a primary physician, I often have patients requesting and even demanding certain procedures when they appear to me unlikely to be useful. And I think some of the concerns that are now being brought out, I find myself using to remind patients that doing these procedures are not benign and that we begin to negotiate whether it's really other ways to maybe see if that head CT scan is really necessary, for example.
Well, you know, down in radiology, we don't keep rigorous track of people's batting averages or positivity rates.
Right.
But we sort of have a feeling about certain indications. You know, when
right.
you see a certain indication, you can just about bet that it's going to be negative.
Right.
And to some degree, you can even sort of – we sort of have a sense about the batting averages of certain clinicians. But especially the indications. And I would hope that by addressing the fact – by recognizing the fact that there is a radiation burden associated with these tests and that it's not trivial, that the risk increases are noticeable, that maybe people might start thinking twice about this and perhaps – we'd alter some of the behavior. I know that some of the exams are ordered because people come in insisting on them.
Right.
And I would hopefully see that practice or that problem lessen mm-hmm. over time. But just mm-hmm. by recognition that there is a cost, there is a downside to these exams. Besides the monetary cost, there's the radiation cost. And we should talk about that, by the way. Let me put that in proper scale. It's estimated in one article that I think was – we talked about this at Pediatric Grand Rounds 2 years ago when that article came out in the Green Pediatric Journal about the 1 in 1,000 risk of inducing a cancer in a child who gets a head CT scan. Mm-hmm. They were using adult doses that were reported from CT scanners in Europe. In fact, we don't use anywhere near those doses in the U.S. So let's say they're off by a factor of 2. So mm-hmm. you're talking 1 in 2,000 chance of inducing a neoplasm in a child from one head CT scan. You have to add that to the background incidence of cancer in children anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
And that number is actually bigger than you think. Lifetime exposure for humans in general or lifetime risk of getting a cancer is about 1 in 5. If you live long enough, it goes to 1 in 3, depending on how you count the cancers. So there's a huge amount of cancer out there. And so that extra 1 in 2,000, are we going to notice it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it would be tough, but the epidemiologists who look at large numbers of populations can notice these things. And more close to home, if your child got a bunch of CT scans for some reason and then your child gets a cancer, you're going to wonder about that. You're going to worry that maybe that one was a radiation-induced neoplasm. There's no way to tell because they're indistinguishable.
Sure.
But you're going to worry about it.
Sure. Which gets back to human nature and cause and effect, coincidence and causality, which I remember Click and Clack, the guys on NPR radio that talk about cars. They did a whole program one time on coincidence and causality. And I think there's a, you know, that's where the MMR and immunization stuff, where people are just jumping to conclusions just because there's a close association in space or time that there's causality. And that's not always the
yeah.
case.
I read an interesting article while preparing for this show. A fellow who made a lot of money and a lot of his academic credentials by helping develop the atomic bomb and perfecting methods of isolating fissionable, you know, the material that goes into bombs. He holds patents on all kinds of ways to extract and purify uranium to make bombs with. And later in life, apparently, he must have gotten the guilt because he now publishes articles about how medical radiation is causing half of all the cancers and half of all the heart disease in the world. And interestingly, he drew a connection between the number of doctors and the number of cancers and showed that the more doctors there are, the more cancers there are. Which is, goes to this question of which came first and are they connected or just coincidental? Actually, speaking of that, there's a misconception I keep running into out there, which is that cancer is rising like a huge epidemic. In fact, it's not. The incidences of most cancers have actually gone down in the past about 8 years. The only one that's not is, I think, breast is leveled off. Colon cancer is way down. Lung cancer is falling. Melanoma is level.
And you're not talking about life expectancy and treatment effects as much as just new occurrences.
I'm talking about incidence.
Yeah.
The incidence of cancers has leveled off or in some cases actually gone down.
What about nuclear nucleoisotope imaging scans, bone scans, and so forth? We haven't talked about that. What are we talking about? How does that change the radiation risk exposure?
Well, in nuclear medicine, we give people material which is radioactive. That is, as it decays, it gives off photons. So the photons that we image are coming from within the patient, from the stuff that we gave them. And then we catch it with a camera that can detect these little photons. And it depends entirely on the agent that you use and how much you give and what the radioactive particle is hooked to, which determines where it goes in the body and how fast it goes there and how fast it gets eliminated. So the doses from some nuclear medicine studies are way lower than the doses from x-rays for similar exams. And some of them are quite high. Cardiac imaging with thallium and with technetium cestamibi or cardiolite is actually quite dose intense. Whereas the dose that you would use to look for kidney troubles in little kids, particularly if you want to see if urine flows backwards from their bladder up towards their kidneys, the dose to the ovaries from doing it with the nuclear medicine method is about 30-fold less than doing it with x-rays.
With the CT.
And ditto the test to see how well their stomach empties out and goes down into the small bowel. If you do that test with nuclear medicine, it's about 50-fold less x-ray exposure than if you had them drink barium and did fluoroscopy.
Which in my mind brings up another issue, and that's the importance of communication between the ordering physician in the radiology department. I mean, with all this advance, and I think this is one of the strategies that I've seen, is that we need to be communicating better and not being hesitant to ask radiologists what is the better or safer procedure, because those are some information that, as a pediatrician, I'm not sure I know as well as I should on a day-to-day basis. Yeah.
In fact, that's one of the cornerstones of the Image Gently campaign is to ask the question, do I need to do this x-ray? Is there a non-ionizing substitute way to make this diagnosis? And I don't expect all clinicians to know how to work up every single problem. And in fact, I do get a few phone calls every day from people calling to tell me about some patient of theirs with a perplexing problem, and they want to know how to go about imaging it. And I actually relish those phone calls. They brighten my day. Because it helps me to figure out the most cost-efficient and lowest x-ray exposure way to work something up. And, you know, being a pediatric radiologist and being a guy who really likes ultrasound, when someone calls me with a pediatric problem, more often than not, I'm going to change them from ordering an x-ray into ordering an ultrasound exam.
Okay. Well, let's talk about other modalities. We haven't talked about MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, and ultrasound. So take your pick, and let's talk about risks there, relative risk to ionizing radiation in particular.
Well, MR has some interesting risks, but one of them is not ionizing radiation. There's the contrast risk that we already talked about, which is only an issue for people who have impaired or poor kidney function where the contrast hangs around for a long time. Most MRIs are done without contrast. And so then the risks simply become the exposure to that powerful magnetic field. And that by itself is not a problem. It's having metal things that are magnetic in the room with the magnet. You know, so there's this flying missile hazard from people walking in there with things in their pockets or whatever. But the laying in the magnetic field is not by itself harmful, and most folks think that the radio frequency signals that we use to excite the tissue and collect the signal back out of there are not harmful. So as far as we know, MRI, with the exception of the flying missiles attracted by the magnet and the contrast in people with kidney disease, has no risk. There is the claustrophobia issue and the long exam time. So kids who are wiggly they're not the best MRI candidates without some sort of chemical help or something. There are downsides, but not great big risks like some of the other modalities. Ultrasound, it has its blind spots. I mean, there are things we can't do with ultrasound. Ultrasound doesn't penetrate that far into people's bodies. So there's some limitations in big people. In small people like kids, you can do a lot more with ultrasound. It's non-ionizing. The only hazard that has ever been reported with ultrasound is when you put a particularly intense beam on developing fetuses. Pulsed Doppler interrogation of small fetuses is thought to cause some disruption of molecules because you're physically agitating the molecules with these sound waves. And the pulsed Doppler beam is particularly more intense. So there are limits on how much you're supposed to expose early fetuses to pulse Doppler. Other than that, ultrasound has no hazards as far as anybody can figure out.
And although it's been probably we've talked around it and it's been implied perhaps in what we're thinking, there are things that a CT does that an MRI doesn't do. And you've kind of implied that there's things that an ultrasound might do that are better. So the choice of these procedures is sometimes based on experience and understanding of what's going on, and oftentimes a CT is not the right study or an MRI is not the right study.
Actually, I forgot one important hazard of MRI.
Okay.
Implanted devices.
Right.
Can't
right.
put a pacemaker in there.
Yeah.
And a lot of other things that the MRI would mess up.
Okay.
But, yeah, the idea as to which test is more likely to yield the diagnosis the fastest and at the lowest cost is it's an art form in a way, and most clinicians don't necessarily know how to work up the entire range of the problems that their patients experience. In a particular subspecialty field like neurology or neurosurgery, they are pretty good about that stuff, but I wouldn't expect a family practice doctor to know the best way of working out an aneurysm of the carotid artery in the head or a particular type of liver tumor. You know, there are different ways of getting after those diagnoses, and I would not expect someone to just know that cold off the top of the head. So that's why we radiologists like to remind people that we're consultants and to consult us.
We've only got about 5 minutes left, Dr. Cruz, but one of the questions that comes to my mind is how do we make sure that radiologists and radiology technicians who are around radiation on a regular basis are not at increased risk? I'm assuming they are not or have not been found to be, and why is that the case? And does that have anything to do with being the radiation safety officer?
Well, yes. I'm not aware of any data that says that people who work lifelong in the X-ray field are dying prematurely of radiation-related disease, not since the first decade of this past century, you know, 1900s, 1910, when they were dropping like flies with rotten fingers from playing with the X-ray tubes. But in the modern era, no, there's no evidence that X-ray techs or radiologists are dying of radiation-related disease, and it's because we have various protection measures, one being the lead aprons that we wear, and the other being the badges that we wear. The badges don't stop the X-rays, but they tell us when we're getting too much, and we have limits set on how much we are allowed to get. And in my capacity as the radiation safety officer, I review the reports on the badge readings for everybody in the department every month, so I can see who's using too much fluoro or who's standing too close to the patient during exposures or who's not wearing their badge at all.
How much radiation would trigger a warning in a radiation technologist or radiologist compared to the number of CT scans someone would have to have? I'm just getting back to this. What's the risk to the patient and who is not wearing one of these badges versus someone who's exposed every day? Is there a way to put that in some perspective?
Well, the annual exposure limit for a radiation worker is 5,000 MR, and you can get that from 1 3-phase abdomen pelvis CT scan, where you get a pre-contrast scan from top of the liver to the bottom of the pelvis, and then one during the arterial bolus of contrast infusion, and then another several minutes later. You get about equal to my annual exposure limit in just one exam.
Okay.
Now, let's say I was getting my annual exposure. Mm-hmm. And then I went and got a CT scan. That's a different account. Mm-hmm. They don't count my medical X-ray exposure against my annual occupational exposure. And if I was dumb enough to wear my badge while I was getting myself scanned, then I probably should be sidelined anyway.
All right. Couple of minutes. Let's sum up. What are the important ideas that we need to get across? Why were we here today? What are we trying to do? And what do people want to come away from this understanding?
Well, I think the reason why I wanted to come on the show, why I accepted your invitation, is because I sense that people are being a little blasé about the radiation exposure from medical imaging exams, particularly CT scans. And I simply wanted to bring that to people's attention so that they might engage in a little bit more questioning about the cost and benefit ratio of a particular exam. In other words, I think that patients should want to know, how is this going to benefit me to get this exposure? How is it going to change the decisions that we have to make about what to do? What's the likelihood that the disease we're worried about is even present in the first place? Mm-hmm. And are there some alternatives? I would actually like to see a decrease in the number of CT scans that are ordered and a corresponding increase in the number that are positive. Somehow I'd like to winnow down the patients who get exposed to the people who most deserve it and who are most likely to have something so that we can help change their management in a beneficial way. That's the benefit that we offer in exchange for the radiation hazard that people are exposed to.
Okay. So there's no evidence right now of any significant problem. There is a increasing awareness of increased exposure related to a number of reasons that have been talked about today that we're trying to get a handle on both from a consumer standpoint and from a professional standpoint.
It's a worry based on the data that came from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where we know that if you get exposed to a certain amount of X-rays, the cancer rates start to go up. And so it's just a statistical thing and a worry thing. Mm-hmm. We can't actually make a clear-cut statement about the numbers of cancers. There are probably some minority opinion holders out there who think that we're causing an epidemic of thyroid cancer, but we can't actually prove it yet. And you can't point in any one cancer and say that one was caused by radiation.
Okay. Well, listen, thanks very much. It's been a pleasure having you here finally.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I hope I helped.
You did a lot. Today's guest is Dr. Brad Cruz, a radiologist at a regional hospital. Next week, we'll be discussing environmental risk. Actually, it's not next week. We're off next week for Labor Day. The week after that, we'll be re-interviewing Devra Davis, a PhD, an environmental cancer epidemiologist. And we'll be talking about her opinion about environmental risk for cancer. So tune into Your Health and learn more Monday, September 8th at 2 p.m., repeating the same evening at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1. For KSKA and for Line One, this is Dr. Thad Woodard.
This has been Line One, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Or email us at lineone@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.